Hi there, welcome to Talk Canicross. I'm Janetta George.
And I'm Gail Walker. We're here today to talk all things Canicross, the fun way to get fit with your dog.
So each month we'll be joined by a special guest or two. We'll hear from professionals, regular Canicrossers, and also dog and human experts in their field. It will be real people and real stories.
So we hope you'll join us, whether it's for training tips, dog talk, or just for fun and encouragement. This is Talk Canicross, brought to you by DogFit. And don't forget to hit subscribe and keep in touch with all things Canicross.
On the 29th of September 2023, our friends and fellow Canicrosser Sue faced every dog owner's worst nightmare. While she was away on holiday, her Labrador Darwin was cared for by a friend. However, he managed to unexpectedly barge out the front door and bolt up the road. It was nighttime, and reports came in that a large black dog had been hit by a car and then run off out of sight into the woods. Sue was contacted immediately and she flew straight back from holiday to find her dog. But given that Darwin had disappeared in a built-up area that he knew well, you might think that he'd been found really quite quickly. However, it was over 6 weeks before he was caught and reunited with Sue. So today we wanted to share this story with our listeners, as there's lots of valuable things to learn about how dogs start to behave differently when they're lost. And we're delighted to have Sue on the show today to kind of tell the story and obviously listen to what she went through and also what was learned by the whole experience. But so welcome, Sue. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Yeah, hi, Sue. Having sort of been through some of it with you as one of your friends, and a lot of them, Janetta's been through it as well, you know, sort of it's a huge story what's happened. But his whole adventure of when he went missing, we're going to obviously talk about that in a moment. But before we do, I think for anyone who doesn't know Darwin and yourself, it'd be really good to get a bit of background about Darwin. And maybe we could talk about his Canicross adventures before we talk about his big solo adventure. Want of a better description. But yeah, tell us a bit about him and how you got into Canicross and how long you've been doing it for, and you know, what have you been up to together when you have gone out and gone running and stuff?
He's 9 years old. He's going to be 10 next April. And we've been Canicrossing since he was about, I think, a year and a half, 2 years old. So, you know, nearly 8 years now we've been Canicrossing together. Introduced to it via a friend from work who was a member of the North Downs Canicrossers, is where I met you and Janetta. And it just started off as a way of me keeping fit. And obviously, he's going to start snoring now because he's next to me. So I don't apologize if you can hear that. It was a way of keeping me fit because I used to go to the gym, but trying to fit the gym in and walking a young dog that requires a lot of exercise was taking up a lot of my own personal time. So it was like, well, why not kill two birds with one stone and actually just go out for a run with your dog in a fun and sociable way? So we did a taste the session with yourselves at DogFit. Absolutely loved it. Came home, ordered the kit straight away and haven't looked back, really. And it's been a great way of, you know, making friends, being sociable on the weekends, running in all weathers where normally you would never leave the house and you find yourself running in the most horrendous weather. I think during lockdown I did some absolutely disgusting runs with Derry where Darwin looked like a chocolate Labrador by the end of the run because he was so covered in mud and I looked like a drowned rat. But you laugh your way around, you have good fun with it. And I suppose, you know, we've run all sorts of places, and it's great because you can take the kit on holiday with you if you're in the UK. Mm-hmm. I had a brief 3 or 4 days down in Dorset a couple of years ago, camping, just me and Dee. And, you know, one day I decided he didn't get a choice in the matter. But we ran part of the Jurassic Coast from the campsite we were in down into Weymouth, stopped and had an ice cream, and then ran all the way back. And it was, I think, just short of 13 miles by the time we got back up and down the hills. He was exhausted, I was exhausted, but we'd had a great day out, you know. And then obviously it was a blog a few years ago, you know, we ran the distance from Land's End to Donna Groats, which were something like 874 miles in 6 months. And, you know, we ran with so many friends to do that, to get the distance. And, you know, we had a brilliant laugh doing it. So, yeah, no, it's been a big part of my life for the last 8 years.
So I was thinking when you said about the first time you tried Pennycross, you went straight out and got the kit, ordered the kit. Exactly the same for me. My first experience, I was, you know, straight online ordering it, and I was getting really itchy. And I think I entered a race like 2 weeks later. It's my second ever Pennycross run, because you do. It's really addictive. And how you described as well when you went to Dorset, it's like, you, rather than running on your own, even just having your dog with you, it's your companion, isn't it? You've got, it's an adventure together.
You know, last year you did our monthly challenges as well, with Darwin collecting all the medals and the rosettes along the way, which is absolutely brilliant. So, it's great. And he is such a lovely dog, and a big black Labrador. I mean, you know, he's got such a look about him, and we're very fond of him. And obviously, when we heard, as you know, on you were away, and we suddenly heard on the within the Canicross community and amongst friends that it's almost unbelievable to hear that he'd gone missing, because he was obviously one of the dogs that we knew so well, that was faithful Labrador, and there was obviously groups coming together while you were flying back. I can't believe how horrendous that journey must have been when you got back. But what was the first thing you did when you, I know we'd obviously got some groups and we'd got out looking, but what was the first thing that you did when you got back?
To be honest with you, the flight was like the longest 14 hours of my entire life, I think, because being completely incommunicado in the air and then turning my phone on when I got back, you know, my phone blew up with messages, and I was desperately searching for the one message that was, you know, don't worry, he's home, he's safe, you know, and being absolutely crushed and jet lagged that he wasn't home. My biggest concern was that he'd gone looking for me, that he was running scared, he would be looking for me, and he wouldn't know I was home, so he wouldn't know to come home because I was there. So that was my sort of really tired brain process at that time, is just walk around the local area, get my scent laid down, because, you know, he would smell me and then come home. And I mean, I was overwhelmed. I didn't realize I knew so many people or had so many people that would care enough to literally put their weekend plans or anything aside. You know, the Canicross friends that I know, they were all out. Work colleagues were out, retired work colleagues were out looking for him. It was just overwhelming.
Everybody just wanted to help. Everyone felt, you know, my gosh, if it was my dog, you know, I'd want to be there looking. And I think there were big groups of people all just, like, as you say, crossing over each other, but all looking to do the right thing, but not what the right thing was.
No, and I think that was the thing. It was just so overwhelming in terms of, well, like you say, it was a built-up area and he hadn't been seen for coming up to sort of 48 hours. And it was like, how can a dog his size not be seen? And because of, you know, 2 years of lockdown and everything, you know, me being seen with him sort of every day walking, whilst I wouldn't necessarily know everyone, people would recognise him. And so there was just this feeling of how can he have just disappeared? And, you know, thinking, oh, maybe he's managed to get himself into a bin shed or a garage or something, you know, and sort of, you know, putting it out there on social media, you know, please, can you check your gardens, your sheds, your garages, the usual, really. And then obviously a friend of mine then saw him, you know, a mile up the road near the fishing lake.
How long after he'd gone missing was that? Was he sighted at the fishing lake?
I think it was. So that was Friday night. He went missing Saturday. 36 hours.
Yeah. So you'd had, from getting home, you'd had a good couple of nights, maybe, from when you sort of travelled to one night. Try to work that out.
One night. Yeah.
You'd had one night and a day, half a day. But it would have been quite. That must have been really hard, those 36 hours. But can you remember how you felt when you heard he'd been sighted? I mean, obviously mixed emotions, I imagine, because he'd been sighted but he hadn't been able to get him. But
yeah, so yeah, I mean, oh my God, the relief that my friend had seen him, and it was, you know, I was satisfied it was definitely him, because my friend knew Darwin and had called Darwin's name, and Darwin had looked at him and everything. So yeah, I got up there as quick as I could, and my heart was racing, thinking, oh, it's fine, he's okay, he's fine. Especially because obviously having heard he'd been hit by a car, you know, your mind goes to the worst case scenarios. And even if, you know, the fact he'd been seen running away from being hit, you know that he could have been just running on pure adrenaline. And, you know, my biggest fear was he had some kind of internal damage done, that potentially he was lying somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, not wanting to say it, but... That's where my mind went. So the fact that my friend phoned me and Darwin's on all four paws looking absolutely fine was just pure relief. And then, okay, that's fine. I'm going to go and get him. I'm going to go and bring him home. But yeah, by the time I got there, Darwin had decided, actually, no, I'm not playing this game, and had retreated back into the woods.
Yeah, because he was frightened and he was just like confused. Do you think that was that?
So my understanding now, having done a lot of more research into this, just, I mean, yes, you can over Google anything, right. but also from speaking to experts in lost dog recovery, is that dogs can go into this, they call it survival mode.
So
dogs that go missing from the home address within normally 24 to 48 hours, apparently, return home. They know their own local area.
Yeah.
If they get a bit spooked, that they go and calm down somewhere and then make their way home. The longer it is, the more they potentially go into this survival mode. So, but the fact that Darwin got hit by the car apparently would have likely sent him straight into survival mode, because he would have then perceived the home area as, this is dangerous. Yeah. I need to get out of here. And so apparently it's almost like flicking a switch, so that when they go into this survival mode, everything is perceived as threat to them. So humans, even if they know them, is perceived as a threat, because their brain is not thinking like domestic Darwin dog. They've almost gone into the sort of prehistoric primeval wolf dog mode of, no, not sure, this is a danger to me. And then so they'll run, they'll move, they'll get spooked even quicker.
I mean, that's the crazy bit, really, because you think that's 36 hours and you've gone from 36 hours to 6 weeks. Somebody's like, oh God.
Just, yeah.
Just so frustrating. But so just sticking with that sort of timeline. So you obviously talked about when you first came home and you had loads of people out helping. And we have to say, you know, the dog community is amazing and the Canicross community is fantastic. One of my late dogs went missing for like 7 hours. I mean, that was bad enough. And so many people came out who I knew through Canicross and just to help. So I understand completely. But I've saw that probably 100-fold with your situation, because it touched the heart of so many people. You know, people who didn't even know you. And there were people coming out and just looking out. Amazing. We'll talk about that a bit later. But you went from those first couple of days where people are just, you're doing what you think instinctively is the right thing to do. And obviously a lot of it was the right thing. But how did you go from that sort of scenario to actually having something much more structured and thought through?
Basically, because I set up a Facebook group, because it was thinking, right, okay, I'm not the biggest user of social media in a public way. I have my own private social media that I share with my friends and family, but I'm not someone who's out there with pages for likes and kudos and everything else. But I thought I don't know how else in this scenario to raise awareness that my dog is missing. I set up this Facebook group that I initially obviously just tagged my entire friends list in, and they then started sharing. I think you guys, you know, shared it. And so suddenly this group was getting people that I had no idea who these people were. They were people in the community. They were people, ultimately, I think I had over 1,500 people in this group in the end. And they were people up and down the country who didn't know me and didn't know Darwin. But then suddenly people started posting and tagging various volunteer charities into the group, saying, oh, you know, if you need drone support, try these people. If you need this, try these people. And one of my friends tagged a lady, I'll just call her Sally, into the Facebook group. And then she contacted me via WhatsApp and started asking me the details. And then she said, right, let's meet. And we met up, and she was brilliant. She provided sort of technical support in terms of, she had wildlife cameras. She told us, you know, where was he last seen? We'll set some cameras up. We'll set some food up, see if we can lure him back to that area. Quite often they'll go back to the area they were last seen. And she sort of said about, start explaining this survival mode to me, that, you know, he wasn't going to just come to me because I called him. I know that sounds really daft. Yeah, exactly. You think that's your dog, they know you, you're going to call their name, they're going to come running. You know, if I did see him, she said, it's all about your body language and, you know, how to get low to the ground, because then you appear less of a threat. Don't make eye contact with them. Don't call their name. So she just provided a lot of, when you understand the survival instinct side of what a dog goes into, is actually really just sensible, practical advice around it. And you know, we'd spent 36 hours or whatever it is, you know, beating bushes, looking, calling his name and all this kind of stuff. And actually she said, right, we need to stop all that now, because he's clearly now in flight mode, and actually doing that is only going to drive him further away because he's scared. So what we need is just sightings of him, so that we can set up cameras and a food station, and then when we got him regularly coming to an area, if he won't come to you, then we then need to start talking about trapping and other options at that point.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because, like, you know, the first instinct is everybody comes out, everybody's walking, you know, and then, you know, we were even camping out kind of late in the night with,
yeah,
I don't know, you know, even if we'd have seen him then, we wouldn't have been able to get hold of him.
But no.
To help, and that was, as you said, until you got some structured advice, it's, you just think, oh, we'll all just go and help search, and it just makes things worse in a way, doesn't it? Well, not worse, because people are there for support, but it's not what needs to happen. And it sounds like you got some just super valuable advice. He was surviving, because you're in a built-up area, so he was obviously getting food from bins, was he? And then in the, how, well, people feeding?
Yeah, we think that the likelihood is he was, well, being a Labrador, they'll eat pretty much anything that's edible or possibly not edible, they'll give it a go. So I suspect there was some rather disgusting carrion eating going on in places. But because ultimately where we found him was on the edge of a built up area, we know people were leaving food out for foxes, so we think he was helping himself to that. And yeah, there were bins and other things. And luckily there was also a freshwater stream running through the area as well. And from what the vets have told me since I've got him back is that, you know, amazingly, as long as they've got access to fresh water, they will survive. They can survive a long time, even if they're on meager rations of food. The fact that he had fresh water the whole time was good, because he didn't come back dehydrated. He came back underweight, but he was not dehydrated.
It's really amazing how resourceful he was in that time, the long time. And it's, you know, he went through, luckily the weather was pretty mild, although there were only a couple of days of rain, wasn't there? But he was out there when it was the fireworks.
He was out there during the fireworks, yeah. And he was out there during Storm Kieran as well, with that massive storm that blew, blew through. But thankfully, he's a gun dog who's not gun shy. So the noise of thunder and fireworks would not bother him. And in fact, you know, we were watching him on camera during the firework, and just not, you could see the light flashes in the sky, and even though it was black and white, you could see when the fireworks were going off, and you could hear some of the fireworks, and he was not fazed by any of it at all, thankfully, whereas I know other dogs potentially would be absolutely terrified by it.
I'm just curious, Sue, so the bit I think is quite hard to get his brain around, he goes missing, and he's been, your friend's seen him 36 hours later. And obviously you've got advice from Sally and she's got all the tech and the cameras. But how did you decide where to set the cameras and where to go looking? Because the other bit that I think we were all observed was before he was sighted again after that, it was a very long time in,
yes,
in real terms. And there were sightings in all these different places, and dogs can travel quite far. I didn't know if he was stationed in one place and he just, you know, and he was just,
yeah,
food and drink from there. And or you might get a sighting like 20 miles away and you're like, looks like it could be Darwin. So that must have been really tough. And then you're thinking, well, what do you do next? And what was the advice you got in that respect?
So, yeah, I mean, we were just advised to, as we could, you know, visit every sighting. The biggest issue was sometimes we'd get sightings come in 2 or 3 hours after someone had seen him. So, of course, the chances are when you get there, he's not going to be there. I tell you that I didn't realise how many dogs go missing on a feels like daily basis, and how many black dogs with red collars go missing, because we were getting tagged in posts, you know, all over the place, not just locally, but we'd been warned, you know, had he been picked up by someone, he could have been taken out of the area. And then when they realise, you know, there's all this stuff on social media about him, just dumping him somewhere. You know, so yeah, I mean, I went out the other side of sort of Bracknell, I think it was. We were having calls to sort of the Reading area, Andover, Southampton, Portsmouth, you know. I mean, luckily I've got some friends who live like local to some of these areas, so they were blessed them going out to check things out for me. I mean, one thing that we thankfully got only one call, but we did get the hoax ransom call. We have your dog. How much are you willing to pay to get him back? But thankfully, Sally had warned us, because you put your telephone number out there, the chances are you will get that occur. But that doesn't mean they've got him. It's that it's someone trying to get money out of you, basically.
Really, that's just, yeah. Something you could do without, when you're going through a torrid time as it is, without having to do it. But that's where Sally was great, though, because she could forewarn you. So
yeah. So it wasn't unexpected, shall we say, when we got that call. Whilst it wasn't nice, at the same time, it was like, no, these guys are just playing us. We think we had a couple of prank calls as well about having seen him. And it's so hard, you know, because they were all, especially the ones that were in the local area, they were all reasonable calls in terms of, you know, because he's fit and healthy, and because of the canny cross, you know, he can comfortably cover miles, and because of, you know, 2 years of lockdown and having to stay local, I'd run and walked pretty much everywhere from home within a sort of 5 mile radius of my house. So it was like, conceivably, if he was scared and on the move, and because of the canal and the Blackwater Valley River, there were so many areas of woodland where around where I live, he could easily get to without being seen if he was traveling at night. Or, you know, you both know the local area. There's so many places you could get to,
isn't it?
And not see a soul.
Yeah.
So that was the other thing, was just like, well, any one of these could be him. I mean, the very last sighting we got of him was following my friend seeing him by the lake, was him then doing the heart-stopping dash down the side of the street, the very busy A331, before he then dashed back into the woods up towards North Camp. And then that was the last confirmed sighting of him for like 4 weeks.
And we then got a message that someone that was out late, so I think it was out in the early hours of the morning, was at a sighting that was the pivotal one.
Yeah, so we got this message that this chap had been walking his dog at, I think it was like 2 o'clock in the morning or something, in the area where we eventually found Darwin, which was only, I think, less than a mile from where he'd been last seen coming off the 331. And the message was basically something along the lines of, saw a large black dog, bigger than my pointer lab cross, ran into the woods. I went back out with treats, couldn't find him. And I remember my friend messaging me saying, oh, we've got this person who's come forward saying that they think they've seen him. And I was at this point just so, not pessimistic, and that's not the right word, but I was like, obviously I'll go and check it out. But, you know, we've had so many of these calls. But at the same time, and there was a part of me that thought, well, this is at 2 o'clock in the morning. This isn't just a black Labrador that's being walked by another owner, that someone may have not realised that the owner's the other side of a load of bushes and the dog's just appeared and then gone back. Because we all know that our dogs will wander off and might appear ownerless.
Yeah.
But actually, you're just around the bend of the lane or something, you know. But this just seemed to be a little bit more like, well, why would another dog be out with a loose without an owner at 2 o'clock in the morning? So I drove and met the witness, and who was lovely, and he explained to me, you know, the fact that this dog had appeared, had sort of gone nose to nose with his dog. He said it was definitely a dog, it wasn't a deer or anything like that, and then it had gone into the woods in a certain direction. And I thought, well, this is probably the most plausible actual sighting I've had for 4 weeks. And it would be logical to him to end up there from where he'd been last seen, going back into the woods off the road. So I went back home with the intention of lunchtime, right, I'll go back up there and start laying down some wildlife cameras and food stations. And I got back home, logged on to do some work. And then my friend banged on my door and said, we've got someone on the phone. And I said, oh, right. She said, she thinks she can see Darwin outside of her kitchen window.
Well, I didn't know this.
And I was like, right, well, where's that? And she said, the same area where that chap saw the dog last night. And so I was like, right, quick, sent a Skype message to my boss and said, right, I need to go. I need to go back out. And luckily, work were absolutely brilliant. This whole 6 week saga, they were absolutely superb. So yeah, got back out to where it was, spoke to the lady, and she was like, "I'm convinced it's him. I'm convinced it's him." But he went back into the woods over there. And we said, "Oh, you know, have you got a Ring doorbell or anything like that?" And she was like, "No, but I think my neighbour does. They're out at the moment, but I'll see if I can get hold of them and see if they can review their Ring doorbell." So. In the meantime, my friend and I decided, right, okay, we'll walk through the woods a bit and we'll see if we can start identifying some areas that would be good to use as food stations with cameras and what have you. In the meantime, another one of my friends had driven up to the area to meet us, to help us. And she phoned me and she said, oh, I'm where we were the other day. And I was like, oh, right, okay. She says, I can see a Labrador in the woods. And she said, but I don't want to go any closer just yet. So I was like, right, okay, stay where you are. And it was literally a few hundred yards from where I currently was. So I walked around the edge of the woods to get to where she was. And she said, oh, it went, she said it was just there. It just went into the woods a bit further along the path there. So I was like, right, okay, fantastic. My other friend said, well, I'll go back around the other side. She said, so I'll head it off if it's going back to where we were just located. And I said, okay, well, I'll stay here for a minute and see if it comes back. My friend who'd seen the dog said, well, I'm just going to go and shift my car because I'm blocking someone in. I saw the dog and sort of just pulled the car up and got out.
Yeah.
So as she went to move the car, suddenly Darwin appeared in front of me in the woods. At which point, everything that I'd been told about get low to the ground, it just went out my brain. And oh my God, that's him. He's alive. That was all that went through my head.
Yeah.
I just remember saying, sorry, I'm getting all emotional. Just remember.
I'm starting to feel like I'm like, well up in a minute. Yeah.
I just remember he stopped and looked at me and I went, hi, Darwin, you want to come home? At which point he turned around and ran back into the bushes. I remember just feeling heartbroken that you know, there's that small part. I knew from everything I'd been told that it wasn't going to be as simple as him seeing me and and coming over to me. But I suppose that part of your brain that's bonded with your dog is thinking they'll see you and be like, "Mum, I'm coming home." Yeah. You know. But it was clear in his flight mode, his brain just didn't register it was me. He just saw a human, i.e. it's a threat. I need to get out of here. So I remember thinking, oh, crap, I need to get down on the ground. I remember then sort of, you know, sitting on the floor in the woods crying my eyes out. And my friend came back and I was just going, it's him, he's alive. You know, and she was like, we're going to get him back. And then my other friend who'd gone to sort of head him off, as it were, the other side, she then rang me and we're talking in whispers. And she's like, I've seen him. But she said, he's run past. And she said, I'm sat on the ground in the woods crying. We're all crying now. And we stayed there for about 20, 30 minutes just in case he came back. But he was obviously so spooked by that point. He was like, I'm disappearing off. So then we had to make a decision of, well, do we stay here? Or what do we do now? So we rang Sally and, you know, I was crying because I'd seen him. But at the same time, it was that kind of bittersweet feeling of, you know, he's alive. That was the
there must have been a lot of relief in seeing him.
That was the biggest feeling was relief, because I always thought he was still out there. Some people were starting to sort of say to me, you know, maybe we need to start a different kind of search, you know, or he's been picked up, he's been taken by someone. Whereas I'm not going to say I didn't have some dark thoughts about what maybe had happened to him, but because of the fact the way he'd been seen running down the road, I thought, okay, that was 36 hours after he'd been hit by the car. So he clearly didn't have, you know, life-ending injuries, because even if he'd been running on adrenaline immediately after the car had been hit, if he had internal injuries, 36 hours, he wouldn't have been seen running down the road like that. There's no way. So I thought, well, unless he'd come to further harm since that incident, he was out there somewhere. And I thought, you know, this goes back to knowing your own dog. I thought, he's just hiding somewhere. He's going to be keeping low. He'll be finding himself food. And it's going to take a chance sighting is going to what stems, you know, kicks it all off. I was just, half of the tears were just the fact he was alive and well, and I could put to bed all the other horrible thoughts that had been going through my brain. And so Sally was like, right, you've got the camera kit. Let's set up the cameras. And hopefully the sighting hasn't spooked him enough that he's going to now move on. Mm. But I felt fairly confident he wouldn't have moved on, because obviously the guy overnight had seen him and that had spooked him. And then he'd been seen by the lady outside a kitchen window and had run off. So I was fairly confident he hadn't gone too far. So we set up four feeding stations around that area.
And so he was here, he was had a source of water, didn't he? And yes. So, like, to your point earlier, he probably found somewhere, he'd probably been there a while, and he'd also got a little routine going where he knew exactly where he would get his food and where he'd get his water.
Well, didn't he?
He probably had his little bed and his little light, and he's like...
I'm pretty certain that he'd ended up there fairly soon, within sort of 24 hours of him being last seen coming off the A331. And there would have been plenty of shelter there for him. As much as it, even now, it breaks my heart to think of him curled up underneath a bush overnight, or during the day, especially in some of the weather we had. You know, I knew that he's a hardy breed. You know, they are... I know we put very much our human emotions, and we humanize our dogs, but they are at the base level. They are an animal that has been, you know, descended from an outdoors animal. We've brought them inside, But, you know, in their genetics, they are designed to be outside and survive. And
but luckily, he's got a thick coat. He's a Labrador. We think he's going to find food versus some dogs that don't have much sort of meat on them or much hair, fur. And like I said, he's okay with loud noises and fairly trafficked. Savvy, haven't you said?
Yeah, I mean, not under normal circumstances, absolutely. You know, when we go canny crossing and we have to cross a road, he will, you know, even when we're on a lane, as soon as there is a pavement or an opportunity to get off the road portion, he is straight off, you know. So he would have been keeping away from traffic and everything else. So I think he found himself somewhere that had water, had shelter, and he could access some form of food.
Yes.
And that he'd been there for like 4 weeks. Yeah. Just we know he was there.
And then you got to this point, so you knew where he was, and you're obviously taking advice from Sally, and you've got the cameras and a feeding station, and then obviously you had a cage set up as well, didn't you? You're putting the food inside.
So yeah, so the first night we set the cameras up, he visited all four food stations. And so that was the first time, really, other than that sort of meeting in the woods, you know, I actually got to see him was images that Sally sent me of him being at all these food stations, which was kind of, you know, incredible, really. But we kept it all off social media. So we felt really bad because the Facebook group that we'd set up, we'd been putting regular updates on there and kept pushing the, you know, can you keep an eye out for him? But then it was a case of, well, we don't want to put this out there just yet because we didn't want well-meaning people suddenly flooding that area, potentially scaring him off and making him move on to another area. So, we couldn't really sort of say anything. I mean, I had a select group of people that we let know we'd found him in terms of we knew where he was. And yeah, he went to all four food stations. Then we put in contact with some people that had a trap that they brought up from Wiltshire for us the next night, and set it up. And we loaded the trap with food, and then that started effectively a week of night shifts of being sat in a car overnight, hoping he was going to go into the trap.
Yeah, and you had an app, didn't you, that would give you a notification every time there was movement.
But you'd think that, again, being so food orientated, he would just go into the trap and that would be it.
Yeah.
But he had other ideas.
Little devil, go on, tell us about it.
possibly the most frustrating week of my life. So he came to the trap. I think after the first night that we set the trap up, he didn't go to the trap. But after that, every single night, he made multiple trips to the trap site. And he could clearly smell the food that we'd baited the area with and within the trap. So to try and just explain how the trap works, it's like a long crate, really. It's like an extended crate with a door that goes up at one end. The theory behind it is the dog goes into the crate where you've loaded the far end with food. There is a pressure plate towards that far end that the dog stands on as it goes to get food, and the door comes down behind it. So that's the theory behind it. Darwin, however, which I have to whilst I called him all sorts of names under the sun watching him on the video because he wasn't doing what I wanted him to do, clearly because he was in this survival mode and was being extra cautious about everything, was thinking, well, I'm not going in there because that doesn't seem right. So decided that he would dig under the trap at the food end because he's not a digger, but he turned into a digger.
Yeah.
Because then the food fell through the trap into the ground below and he could get the food.
Yeah.
And hopefully not set the trap off, because I guess if the door had pinged shut and made a noise and a racket, he would have completely understood what that was about. And not quite.
Yeah. So because he didn't go in and it didn't trigger the plate,
yeah,
he managed to get the food without triggering the trap.
The trap at that point didn't have a base, did it? So it was just, there were gaps, like it was fully, you know, like a cage underneath. So yeah, he had to dig, and the food, he could get to the food. Yeah.
Yeah.
The chicken that you laid out for him.
Yeah, exactly. Roast chicken, and it was sardines and whatever else we could find. So after that, we then put a base underneath the trap. And that night he still tried to dig and obviously didn't get any food that night. So it was like, right, come on, D, work this one out. You're not stupid. Figure out how you're going to get this food. So we then started sort of loading bits of food down the trap to sort of try and encourage him to go down it.
Yeah.
And then we had several nights of him going so far down it and then coming back out, back out again. And it was like, oh, come on, dude, just the jackpot is at the end. You must be able to smell it. Just be a Labrador and
go for it.
No, so he wouldn't do that. So then we started exploring, well, is it the size of the trap? Is that what the problem is? And do we need to get a bigger one? And so we contacted another charity and discussed the options with them. And they sort of recommended maybe switching a few things up in the trap, like having hay on the ground, because apparently that's a more natural feeling for them to go from like the grass to then the hay. So we were like, okay, let's try that. So we effectively deactivated the trap for one night, where we bungee corded the door open so that even if he stood on the pressure plate, it wouldn't trigger the trap, if that makes sense. And so again, we loaded the far end with food, and that night he went all the way in and had food. So we're like, okay, we can do this. So
why did you deactivate it for that one night? You know, like you said, if he triggered it, wouldn't put the, why did you?
Because we almost like went back to basics of like trying to desensitize him to it by changing things up. It was like, right, he might be more suspicious, and so let's. And it was also because by this point we were absolutely exhausted, because I was awake all night, you know, pretty much watching the cameras to sort of try and see him go into it. So it was almost like needing a decent, it sounds daft, but needing a decent night's sleep. I don't think I ever got a chance to really deal with my jet lag, because I literally flew back from the other side of the world and then just didn't have a proper night's sleep for, you know, nearly 6 weeks. Well, it was 6 weeks by the end of it. So again, there was the sort of recommendation from the experts of, you actually need to get some sleep, because actually you're going to be no use to him if you are in an overly emotional, tired state trying to make decisions and do things. So yeah, we deactivated it for the one night. He went all the way in and got food and then came out, and we thought, okay, actually that's not a bad thing, because that will now give him some confidence that nothing bad happens when you go in. And he'd got a good reward of having food. I mean, he ate a lot of food that night. So probably the most he would have eaten in a while. So we were like, okay, brilliant. So then we set the trap the following night. And we all were like, right, this is the night he's coming home. Set it all up and watched the most frustrating footage of Darwin going into the trap and managing not to trigger the plate whilst eating all the food at the far end. But he was like, oh God, how have you been? And he went in more than once. It's like, how have you managed to do that? And, you know, he's got quite a long neck and a long nose on him. And clearly he was just managing to sort of lean over and get the food and not actually trigger the plate. So again, felt so deflated and so frustrated. So another one of my friends had an idea of like, right, basically getting a marrow bone and cable tying it to the furthest end of the trap that we could, with the idea that that might get him frustrated enough that he couldn't get, like, pick it up, that he might start pawing at it and he'd be a bit more animated down the
thing.
That end of the trap. So we tried, we went up there, set it up, came away. Sally and one of my friends, Kathy, sat up in the car park doing the late shift, as it were, whilst I was at home. And we got a text to say, oh, he's in the area. I was like, okay, brilliant. But again, to a certain degree, wasn't too hopeful because of everything that had gone before. And then about 9:15 that night, my friend Kathy group calls me and my friend Emma, who lives next door, and she said, he's in the trap. And my brain went, oh, okay, brilliant. He's in the trap.
Not in the trap.
Yeah. And then there was this expectant pause. And then I was like, sorry, do you mean he's trapped or he's gone into the trap? And she was like, no, he's trapped. He's in the trap. So where my brain was at that point, at which point I just burst into tears. I could hear Emma crying down on the other line. And my friend Kathy said, it's all right. He's safe. He's calm. You know, I'm going to go up and sit with him. I'm going to go and sit with him until you get here. And I was like, okay, brilliant. And I could hear Emma saying, I'm going to come round to yours. I'll drive you up there. We went in my car, actually, in the end. But Emma arrives and she was crying and I was crying. And we got into the car. I texted my mum and my sister to say, he's in the trap. But he's actually trapped. And we're going to get him, but don't phone because not sure what we're going to, you know, find when we get there, kind of thing. And I just remember crying all the way up to the location in the car thinking, one, this is the last time I'm going to have to do this journey. was the realisation that I was bringing my boy home.
Yeah.
I was dating him and I was going to bring him home.
Yeah.
And sorry.
Oh, it's very special. That's going to stay with you forever, obviously. A very special emotional moment. But just the happiest of things, because it had been a couple of weeks, hadn't it, from when he'd been sighted and you'd been monitoring him, and it gets to the point where you're thinking, my goodness, you know, and trying to relay that back to people that's it's a long time, and just seeing him get around every way and means, you know, it must be so frustrating. But I think for the rest of us on looking and seeing it all happening, you're just thinking, oh, it's a matter of time, but no one thought 2 weeks.
I know.
Yeah.
I think it was 12 days, I think it was, from the point that we first saw him to when we brought him home.
When you went to the, so you've obviously arrived at the and it's at night, in the middle of the night. So
yeah.
What was he just calm in the cage then? Or was he?
Yeah, he was calm. So we'd borrowed red head torches because that doesn't blind the animals, it doesn't ruin your own night sight. We went up there and I just remember him sitting in the crate by the light of this red light, and I just sort of went up, you know, hello baby, you know, it's mummy, you want to come home? And it was just no recognition. It was, he was just sat there looking, he was calm, It wasn't, you know, I suppose in my head still I had this sort of joyful reaction sort of idea of he was trapped, he couldn't go anywhere, he was going to see me. But no, he was just sort of sat there calmly looking at me. And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to get food out because we know how much he likes his food. And I had cocktail sausages with me and I was sort of poking those through the crate at him. And he was just letting them drop to the floor of the crate. Oh, and wow. I was like, oh, okay, that's not normal behavior. And so I think I was sat there in the end for about 40, 45 minutes just next to the crate. And I just remember talking waffle to him. You know, oh, do you want to come home? Everyone's really been missing you. And, you know, when we get home, we can do this, we can do that, you know.
Yeah.
And slowly, I suddenly realized he was starting to, I mean, you both know Darwin. And he's starting to tilt his head when he was listening to me. Oh, wow. And I remember saying to him, you know, well, we can go see grandma this weekend. The head went. And I said, because, you know, grandma's been missing you as well. And you know, we'll go and see your Auntie Ying at the weekend. And the head was starting to tilt more and more. And I was like, okay, maybe something's starting to register with him. So I started trying again with the food. And he was sort of tentatively taking the food from me. And So I just carried on talking to him, and then I was starting to ask him to do things for the food. So this is all stuff that I used to do with him when he was a puppy. So to get food, he used to say, right, I used to put my hand in a fist and then get him to touch his nose to the fist to then release the food. And I'd used to say touch, and he would touch the wrist, the fist, and then I'd open my hand. So I was starting, there was a gap at the top of the crate. And so I was starting to put my hand in and telling him to touch. And suddenly his nose was touching my fist. And then I was sort of saying to him, oh, right, okay, now sit. And he would sit up and then, you know, high five. And he was starting to high five me. And I was like, okay, so there's obviously something now that's there's recognition there. Even if it's something deep down, there's something in your brain that is recognizing these games that we play. So by the time he was doing all this, it was like, okay, let's try extracting him from the crate and seeing how we get on. And so we managed to finagle, I think, two different slip leads through the top of the crate. I had his halter lead, because he still had his collar and his ID and everything on him. Managed to get a halter lead through, clipped to his collar. And it was only at that point when we had all of us like stood around, I think. All hanging on to him in some way. It was like, right, okay, let's open the crate door. And as he came out, I straight away put his walking harness over his head and clipped that to him. And he came out of the crate, he stood there, he looked at all of us, and then his tail was just wag. And he was like, he was just going, okay, this is fun, right? Are we going home? What are we doing? He was just like greeting everyone like he normally would. And it was just bizarre. So it was like, I looked at Sally and she was like, come on then, let's get him back to the car. So I had the halter lead wrapped around my waist attached to his harness, and I had hold of a slip lead in my hand as well, just in case he was going to suddenly bolt again or anything. But he scent trailed us all the way back through the path down to the car, and as we approached my car, I beaked the unlock. And he went straight to the back of the car. I opened the boot, he jumped in, laid down on the bed and looked at all of us just to say, okay then, that was a nice walk, are we going home?
Toe rag.
That was one of the politer names.
Yes, well, I'm just thinking for the podcast this level. Yes.
Oh, darling. I just remember sitting in the boot of the car, like on the edge of it, and he just came and sort of lay now next to me as if to say, yep, okay, and now what are we doing? So it was like, okay. So I clipped him to the boot of the car using my Canicross splitter, actually. Yeah. So I got clip to the crate at the back, because I don't have a dog guard on the boot. So that was clipped to the crate part at the back, clipped to his harness and shut the boot, drove him home. And my neighbour's husband was waiting outside as we got there. Got him out the car. He went straight up and was like, hello, you know, like he normally would. Took me straight up the front path to my front door. We all of us piled into my small lounge, let him off the lead, and he went straight over to his treat tin and started bashing it with his nose, which is what he would always do when we got in from a walk, as if to say, right, I'm home, so where's my treat? And I said, well, you need to get on your bed. And he jumped straight on his bed.
Well,
had his treat, and then he was just motoring around the lounge like he'd never been away. And you know, he hadn't been in my house for 9 weeks by that point, because he'd been staying with my next door neighbour.
Yeah, well, I remember asking you, Sue, what to expect when you did finally get him home, and you said you've got to treat him like a rescue pup, because that's what you were probably expecting, that it might take a little while, build that bond again and that relationship. But it sounded like it sort of fast tracked.
I'd be warned that either his brain would switch and he'd be back to just being Darwin, or exactly that I had to treat him with a bit of sort of kid gloves and rescue dog and rebuild a bond and get him reassociated with the house. But for him, it was like Jekyll and Hyde. It was, you know, gone from this scared dog that ran away from me to literally coming up and snuggling and cuddling, and like he'd never been been away.
And his health as well. You said he was hydrated. And had he not, how much weight do you think he had lost?
He'd lost 6 kilos in weight. That was the thing that I struggled with the most visually looking at him. He was what I'd call stray skinny. You know, his hips and his waist were very small. I mean, for a Labrador, he's very lean under normal circumstances. He's not a big chunky lab or anything like that. He's long legged. He's a lean muscly boy. But he'd lost 6 kilos in weight, so he'd obviously been living off, lean rations whilst he was missing. But that was literally the only thing. The vet checked him over, heart good, he wasn't dehydrated. There was no injuries from the incident with the vehicle. He was a bit shy of traffic for the first sort of few days when I was walking him. Whenever a sort of vehicle came past us, he was sort of shy a bit and sort of look round a bit. But I mean, we're now three and a bit weeks that he's been home, and he's back to normal as far as traffic is concerned.
Really impressive, because I can understand why he would be potentially scared of traffic, and to get back to his normal ways. Right, that's quite amazing. And what a resourceful boy,
The vet said to me, he's a bit of a miracle. He said, that he was a clever boy. He just did what he needed to do to survive until I could find him, really. So
if only dogs could talk. I mean,
I know.
God, there's so many things you'd want to ask, aren't there? Where was he sleeping? What was he up to?
The lovely thing is, I'm home now, and it's a really happy ending to it. Just before we kind of finish, what bit of advice would you give us? Because as you've said, there are so many dogs that go missing. Obviously, not for 6 weeks, but
no.
When someone does lose a dog and it has gone on for a little while, what was there anything you would have done differently? I know you were actually out of the country coming back, but
I think I now know that perhaps all the searching and stuff we were doing initially, and some of the things we were trying, maybe were a bit counterproductive. But I would encourage people to get in touch with one of these charities soon and start discussing what your options are with them, because I mean they were brilliant. I mean, one of the ladies effectively ran our social media for us, which again took the pressure off me, because I wasn't having to think about what to post and how to engage and things like that. And she sort of took over the admin running of the page and assisted in putting images and videos and everything together. You will find a lot of people tag you in various drone groups and stuff like that. And drones do have their place, absolutely. But certainly in the highly wooded area that we were searching, it's not as easy. If it's a large sort of farmland area, you'd have better luck. But because of the dense woodland, even the thermal drones weren't likely to pick him up. So whilst drones are great and have a place, for me, it wasn't the most ethical thing. But I would just say don't give up hope, because you can have this result, really. I mean he's back to normal. I'm still living with the consequences of his little mini adventure, in as much as he's not been off lead per se since he's been back. He walks on a long line now when I take him out, which he hates, but he's got to earn my trust again now. And it's tough, because he didn't go missing from a walk. But it's my paranoia of letting him out of my sight at the moment. But he's got a tracker on him now, which I would never have thought of getting, because I had no reason to think about getting one, because he's never disappeared from my sight like this before.
No, I've even walked him, haven't I?
And yeah, you
just said he's fine going in your car, you can have him off lead. Never been on me before. Obviously he knew me from Canny Crossing, and he was off lead and we did an hour's walk together.
Yeah.
But like I say, it was a very different scenario. It wasn't his usual self, because he was, and he got spooked and so forth. So But yeah, I can understand, because it's that's probably what was hard to get your head around. He's one of those easy dogs, you know, he just walks by your side.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. So many of my friends said, you know, but this is Darwin. He's not a reactive dog. He's not a, you know, he's not a dog easily spooked or anything. And he's friendly and he's food orientated. And like you say, he's an easy going dog. I mean, he's very laid back. He's so his behavior during that period was just so at odds with everything I think that any of us that knew him would recognize.
I think that's one of the reasons we wanted to kind of share this story, because you know, you think your dog would never do anything like that, and you know, it just shows you that they will kind of revert to survival mode. And you know, it's no reflection on anything, it's just that's what they do. So but
yeah,
the best thing is the happy ending at the end. And you know,
yeah,
we can't wait to see him out on a Canicross for us when you're
well, that we've been given the all clear by the vet now that I can start effectively doing couch to 5k with him and start building some of that back back into him now, because
it'll be good for both of you, won't it, for you as well, because it's getting back into that sort of that was your favorite thing to do with him, or one of your favorite things.
Yes.
You haven't been able to do that. And I think for you, because you say it's been hard for you to get over it. You know, Darwin, my happy's back, he's sleeping and eating, and he's got his nice warm bed, and he's got his mummy back, and he's got, you know, his home comforts. But that's something that was very important to you, the Canicross, wasn't it? So,
yeah. I mean, even it's amazing how you don't realise how much they, you know, dictate your daily routine having the dog. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's the little things, like even the fact that on the days that I was working from home, you know, I could roll out of bed sort of 15 minutes before I had to log on, as long as I had time to put the kettle on and log in. And whereas having him, I'm always up at least an hour beforehand to feed him, walk him. And it's all those little things that you suddenly realize, you know, oh gosh, that, you know, they're a big part of your life, obviously, but how much they dictate your daily life. And so there was this absolutely massive hole in my daily routine, which, you know, I've now got back again, thankfully.
We couldn't be happier for you. I mean, and like I said earlier, it was just to see that whole the community coming together to your story is huge. And I think it just shows how much people, you know, there are lovely people, kind people out there, and definitely
absolutely. It was very supportive throughout that whole process. You know, to keep me going, really. And I do have the most incredible bunch of friends, you know, yourselves, you know, the Canicross community, you know, work, just personal friends, everyone just rallied round. And the WhatsApp group that we'd got set up for helping search for him, I know that when, you know, we posted in that at 11:30 at night, or wherever it was that he was home, the amount of people that seem to be awake at night and
the
messages through was
incredible. It's true. I'd go to bed at night, and the last thing I'd think of was Darwin, and the first thing in the morning I'd think of, because I was like, any updates? And I think you're right. Everyone was just following it, because everyone wanted to hear some the good news that you found him, and everyone was on tenterhooks. But oh, so happy for you, and happy that you've got your D-dog back and he's fitting well. And it's good. Yeah. He's I've seen some, obviously some photos. He's had a posh photo shoot as well, hasn't he? He's a bit of a, you know, front page glamour dog now, isn't he?
He turned into a local celebrity, and it's been mind blowing, really, because the chap from Surrey Hills Photography, you know, got in touch and was like, oh, I'd love to give you a complimentary shoot to celebrate him coming home. And you know, I just find I'm walking him and people will go, oh, is this Darwin? And I don't know who they are, but they recognize him.
I'm so pleased that you've come on to share the story. I know everyone is hugging their dogs a little closer and keeping an eye on them. But we'll put some links as well to remember the charities that helped you, kind of helped you find him. And yeah, as you said, keep positive. If someone finds themselves in this position, to keep positive, and it's amazing how the dog community come together.
So. I'm looking forward to seeing the movie next, because that's obviously coming, isn't it?
That's why people said to me, when's the book coming out?
Yeah, there you go. Like in the movie. Yeah.
Darwin.
Netflix.
Well, thanks, Cindy, and we'll see you soon. Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Sue.
No problem.
Bye. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Canicross. We really hope that you've enjoyed it. But don't forget to hit subscribe so we can keep you up to date and let you know when the next episode comes out. Happy canicrossing.